Accession number 16427, Major Thomas Ward, reel 14.
Major Ward, reel 14. I was asking you what effect the terrain Italy had upon operations, and in particular on your close support operations. And I think you said that the Germans had the advantage of finding good defensive
positions. Well, it favoured the Germans, obviously, because they picked their positions, and then we had to winkle them out. Oh, I mean, the army had to winkle them out, and we had to help them. They naturally were able to camouflage their positions better in such terrain. So, under certain circumstances, the prepared positions were not so easy to find from the air. And that's the difference.
Equally, though, one might say that elevations like mountains could give points of observation, which we might use, whereas in the desert, it's difficult to find such.
Well, in the desert, it was sometimes impossible to get a good observation point. In fact, we were not operating over paddy in the desert, so we were not seeking observation points. We were relying on the observers with the pilots to spot the Germans. That was different. Now this time they were relying on us to give them a target.
Ground observation. Was that the principal difference?
I would explain that these pilots who came over to Rover Paddy, perhaps I'll explain first of all cab rank. A cab rank, we called it, was six fighter bombers, armed with 500-pound bombs, led by a very experienced, usually led by a very experienced pilot, perhaps a squadron leader, certainly in the initial stages, many Battle of Britain pilots were still flying and doing magnificent job. Now, they would call Rover Paddy when they came over our location and ask for a target. That was there was a procedure for this. We usually had a target for them. If we didn't, they had an alternative target. Now that was important. Then it wasn't wasted. They went off to do something else with their bombs. But where we had good observation, or where we had good help from the mosaics, we could talk to the pilot on a particular farmhouse or a church or something. And there he was. He was circling round and looking at it from all angles. And often they would say, "I'll just go round and have another look, see which is the best way to go in." And, it was really, we were involved through the pilot, in the actual attack, it seemed. That's why it was so interesting. And then we, after they'd left, we frequently got the results from the forward troops. And if it was an accolade, well done, we quickly signalled this to the squadron. And by the time the cab rank had landed, perhaps there was a well done, Desert Air Force, or thank you very much, you've done a good job. I've got several of these, which of course you've seen, and from brigade commanders, from division commanders, And I've also got signals from the Chief of Staff, 8th Army, which I've shown you, which says, "Well done, Rover Paddy, keep it up," from General de Gingold.
How close to our own forward troops would attacks be made? What was the safety margin in Italy?
Well, we judged it. Well, I often discussed it with the forward commanders. Now, there was often a discussion on, are you going to give us any signals like smoke? Or are you going to send up very lights, or just to give the pilot the exact location of your forward troops? We felt eventually that safety was, 500 yards, but we've been 200 yards strafing.
This is with attacks with gun rather than with bombs?
No, attacks with the guns, yes, the rockets. Little rockets, yes.
Rockets, I was going to ask you
did use those eventually.
So you had three weapons.
On one particular, I haven't got it with me, I was going to read it to you, but one particular message from the brigade commander at the time said, "Magnificent job, 200 yards from our own troops. The 200 Germans are now walking towards us with their hands up." Well, now, we of course quickly passed that message on to the pilots. If they were still in the air, we could tell them. But certainly it went back to Desert Air Force and to the squadron and also to Army headquarters.
Another question which is important, I think, is how many sorties in a day a cab rank could make? How many times could the same pilots come out to give close support? Now here there's a list in front of me headed Summary of Allotment of Cabs. And I see it says on 11th of April, presumably that's 1945, or would it be some other time? It says 18 cabs and 3 Timothys. What's a Timothy?
A Timothy is 24 aircraft. A cab rank is 6 aircraft.
What sort of targets would you engage with a Timothy?
Well, a Timothy was really an engagement Army headquarters would arrange with the Desert Air Force. We very rarely got involved in that kind of operation because this meant more preparation and availability of aircraft and that kind of thing.
So would it be more of a set-piece target?
Yes.
Than a...
Yes. And not necessarily so close to the troops. Possibly on machine gun emplacements or probably artillery probably the German artillery had been spotted and located, and it was probably a real concentration on the artillery, supporting the German forward troops.
When Rover Paddy had been set up, were you working directly to Army headquarters, or were you attached to a corps or a lower formation?
The 5 Corps were commanding the forward troops, mostly going up on the east side. We nearly always, we were always on the Five Corps front, yes.
Were you in support or were you under command of Five Corps?
We're not under we had a peculiar assignment, really. We pleased ourselves where we went.
You chose your own location.
Chose our own location. But always kept everybody informed where we were. And always, if the forward troops moved up, we moved up. We never settled back to, if we got a comfortable spot to have an extra day or two. There wasn't time. But I always remember Rover Paddy days as busy days. Now, there were many lulls in the battle. There were long periods of stagnation during the winter, particularly. But if we were not actually directly involved in an attack or a defensive action, I'd be off looking for another OP further forward.
How far forward would you put your OPs?
We would always be... bear in mind that we had very important vehicles. I'm thinking about the signal vehicles. We had three vehicles in with VHF sets, which we used to talk to the aircraft. We always had a spare of something in case something broke down. Obviously, that was very essential.
A reserve set.
That's right. And if perhaps when we were shelled, we might, I remember we had a vehicle hit once through shelling, and that was one of our VHF sets. Unfortunately, I lost one of the operators there. Very sad. But so. Any location had to be very seriously considered if we were going to be together as a unit. But many times I was forward with the RAF personnel I'd got with me, probably on the OP with the vehicles further back. But it didn't really matter because... we had marvellous communications with them, and we could easily keep in very close touch.
So the important thing would be to have your communications vehicles in a safe location, but obviously the forward observers would have to expose themselves to a certain degree of risk in order to see what they needed to see.
Yes, I remember in one particular case in the middle of Italy, I was actually looking for an observation point, and I came across quite a tall building, and it turned out to be an ex-fascist headquarters, but our own troops were using it. The Indian, it was on the Indian front.
4th Indian Division.
4th Indian Division. I went into this building and upstairs, and from the bedroom window I had a magnificent view. I think it was three stories. And I thought, well, yes, we can establish ourselves here because we can see for a long, long way. And then suddenly... we were shelled and got a direct hit. The building got a direct hit. And there was complete confusion, actually. But I started to fall. And I went through two floors and finished in the kitchen. In the middle of about half a dozen Indian troops drinking coffee. So that'd come through the ceiling. They were very surprised. And I was actually, but fortunately I was wearing long leggings. Very fortunate that day, so otherwise I'm sure I would have broken my leg or something. I knew I'd broken a finger because it was bent back, but I was dazed, and then I was picked up and dusted down, and I was severely bruised, but it was obviously I had to go and get some attention, and I was taken off to a forward dressing station.
Was this an Indian Division forward dressing station?
It was, yes. Then I was passed down to another one, and a third one, and there was a message waiting for me. Have given strict instructions. You are not to go any further. Hope you're able to stay with us. That was from Five Corps headquarters. And that must have been Toby Lowe, who was the chief of staff, my contact there, and with Raymond Foster, Major Raymond Foster, who was frequently visiting us, because he was really the liaison between Toby Lowe and myself. And they said, "Bad job, you must be important." And I said, "Well, I'm all right, I can go back." She says, "No, they actually said, no, well, look, we'll keep you here, but let's see how you are." Well, it turned out that I was back with Rover Paddy in about 4 days, and with my arm in a sling and and looking as if I'd been knocked about a bit, but I was jolly pleased to get back. Because if you start getting passed on from hospital to hospital, you soon get lost, and then you're out of it. And I regret to say that was the beginning of some severe back trouble I developed. Not immediately, but it came on gradually. And well, I won't go into the details, but I've had two serious operations and over the last 50 years. And I've still got the trouble, but that's how it is.
Did the doctors at the Indian dressing station, all the other clearing stations, you went to examine your back when you passed down the line?
Well, I don't know what happened, really. I think I passed out, But
presumably you were given some...
I don't remember going to the first dressing station.
You don't?
No. But I do remember the Indians in the kitchen. And I think... I don't know what happened there. But I do know that I had a broken finger. So at least it wasn't more serious.
Who actually sent in the requests for targets to you? Did those come from a division or brigade or battalion level, or did they come from 5th Corps headquarters?
All of them.
All of them?
All of them. It depends how urgent they were. If it was an urgent request from a battalion commander, perhaps, we were able to...
respond.
Respond. We reached the stage, really, when if there was an emergency and if we had a continuous shuttle service, well, that's what we called it, these cab ranks, a shuttle service, and coming in every 10 minutes or quarter of an hour, six different aircraft, if there was real activity. If that happened, then... we were very rarely out of a suitable target, because there were, they came in from a lot of angles. Some targets we kept, which were less urgent.
They were reserve targets.
Reserve targets. And dealt with them a bit later if something else came in. We had to concentrate on the battle situation, really. It was up to the army headquarters and divisions to keep us informed about the battle and what was happening, and whether they were going to move forward or move back. That was very important to us in case the front line changed the location.
Did you have a plotting table on which you could update the information?
No.
You're relying on maps with China graph.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it was. We each had a map case and things like that. You've got to walk about with it and so on. And it was a very, very busy day. It was Rover Paddy when we were softening up the front German line, when we were told to continue to attack all day. Probably the first cab round would come over and the leader would call us, "Hello, Rover Paddy." That might be 6 a.m. And then that would continue until dusk, until they stopped flying. We didn't do any cab ranking in the dark.
Presumably you couldn't do it if the weather was bad as well.
That's right. But if the weather was fine, then that was the opportunity to use them and take advantage of them.
Presumably you had to coordinate your efforts with those of the artillery to make sure you didn't duplicate targets.
It's very important that we had an efficient artillery officer, as a liaison officer. We always had him. Same with the tank regiment. We had an officer who knew. Probably it might be an officer from the squadron who was actually doing the job in that particular battle. Because they knew what was likely to happen. Now, we had Rover Paddy in armoured cars at times with the same BHF sets talking to the aircraft. We, in the Po Valley, we were in tanks.
What sort of tanks? Do you remember?
I don't know. But there was a lot of activity in the Po Valley, and there hadn't been a great deal of opportunity to use tanks over the rivers and things like that when we were gradually going up. But the Po Valley, there was great activity with tanks.
It's more open country, presumably.
Yes, more suitable country. Frankly, I was pleased we were not in tanks very much because I didn't like it.
Why was that? What
well,
didn't you like?
Claustrophobia. You know, I suppose you've got. Four years we've been out in the open. And,
but you'd flown in aircraft, and
yes,
feel claustrophobic in those.
Well, no, I didn't. No, not in an aircraft. No, just that a tank is. There's not much room in a tank.
And but there's more room in an aircraft.
And I think it was probably the heat in the tank as well.
The heat?
Yes.
What about the level of noise?
The noise.
In tanks and aircraft.
Yes, that was another thing. I didn't like a tank, but admired the lads who were in the tanks.
What about the armoured cars? Did you feel the same about them?
Yeah, they were slightly different. We were not so far forward in the armoured cars. And we could sit up and
You could have your head out.
Have my head out, yes. Yes.
Were you the only rover unit? Were there other rovers?
No, well, there was a rover David developed. One of the ALOs, Ron Taylor, he was a friend of mine. In fact, I'll tell you later, we'd done a course together, actually giving a course together, and he was a very experienced ALO, and he was put in Rover David, and eventually he went to the Americans. He was posted to the American front. Well, to do the same thing, close support for the Americans, and that actually developed, and he was the focus on that. But he operated as one of our tentacles at the time. But that was a great development, because it meant that we were being successful on the Five Corps front, and the Americans were taking interest in this development.
And they wanted something similar.
Yes.
What is a tentacle?
Well, a tentacle was a VHF set, if you like, talking to the aircraft.
So it was a forward air controller?
Well, it was a branch of whatever we were doing, you know.
And
you'll notice in the notes here we talk about juniors. There were, I had two ALOs with me, supporting me. Fortunately, when I was wounded, one of them took over my job while I was absent for 4 days. Got to do that, got to continue whatever happens. And as I say, the radio sets and that kind of thing were duplicated, so they were not lost.
How did Rover David and Rover Paddy get their names?
Well, it was interesting. Rover Paddy was named after Paddy Green. He was a wing commander in the Desert Air Force. He'd been a leading light in the Battle of Britain, and he'd actually been posted to Morrow for a few weeks, I remember. And we wanted a name, so we said, well, why not Paddy? Paddy was a great character, and it was Rover Paddy. Rover David was named after David Haysham, similar to Paddy Green from the Battle of Britain. He's a squadron leader. He's commanding one of the squadrons. And he did a magnificent job in Kavrank and so on. And that's where that name came from, David.
If you had all your observers forward and out, how many cab ranks at a time could Rover Paddy handle?
Well, we control the cab ranks. They're not the tentacles which went out didn't interfere with the cab ranks.
What were they doing then?
Well, they were in in contact with the forward troops, and we got information from them. That was useful to make sure that we knew. That's one of the main sources of supply there for information from the army. Yeah. Although 8th Army were magnificent sending their reports, but of course there was also delay there.
So you wanted
it was quick action. Quick action, yeah. Particularly if we were operating. And we were on that particular front. We wanted somebody closer to the unit doing the job. And that was it.
What sort of area could a cab rank cover? I mean, presumably there would be more than one cab rank in the air at a time over a core front.
No,
there wasn't one.
Just drove a rover paddock.
One cab rank per core.
Yes. Because usually, when there was an attack, it was on a fairly narrow front. We were only operating on the eastern side of, mainly on the coastal side of Italy, as we went up. And therefore, these attacks were where the Germans were defending, and it was usually not very far from the coast and or wherever. Otherwise we could go around, couldn't we? It was somewhere where you couldn't bypass the river without going over it.
You mentioned the operations on the Sangro. Do you remember anything particular about those attacks that struck you at the time?
Well, all these followed similar pattern. I don't quite honestly, it's a lot, not the details, but I have it in my notes, and we have a battle order and everything.
Do you remember any changes that occurred in the way things were done after Montgomery had left? With the change of command, was there a change of style or anything else that you...
Well, there was a change in forward troops.